VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
He felt terrible because he was clearly going to ruin my vacation.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to Danny in the Valley. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. I have a great show for you today. I'm talking to Pete Flint, who's a Brit. He's been out here in Silicon Valley for 14 years. He actually got his start in the late 90s at lastminute.com. Then he came out here and started another company called Trulia, a real estate listings website that started out small, got very big very quickly. And he sold it. He listed it on the stock market and then sold it a couple years ago for $3.5 billion. That netted him a payday of $150 million. So not bad going. So since then, he has remade himself into an angel investor and now a professional venture capitalist at his firm called NFX. They've just raised a big new fund, $150 million, to invest in seed and early stage companies. So we'll be talking to Pete about his whole journey from those shores to these. Before we get there, I just wanted to mention two housekeeping notes. One, this is the penultimate episode of Danny in the Valley for season one. Yes, we have one more episode after this one next week before I take a break for Christmas. And next week's episode is kind of a bit of a grand finale. We're putting together a special kind of deep dive, which I think you guys will enjoy. But we use that time to take off and line up a bunch of great new guests for the upcoming season. I think you guys will really enjoy it. So this, as I said, one more episode next week, and then we're off for a bit over a month. And the other thing is, I wanted to just thank you, loyal listeners, because recently we passed 100 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, which is just amazing. And that's in the UK and US stores. So I just wanted to read out a couple of these that you guys have so generously put up. One is from Ian Woosnam, who says, I subscribe to quite a few tech podcasts, and in a very short space of time, Danny in the Valley has become my favorite and an absolute must. With a genuinely outstanding guest list, Danny's sympathetic and quietly probing interview style. Thank you, Ian. Gets into the real stories and the impact of technology across a huge range of industries and markets. Brilliant. Thank you, Ian. John Stanley, UK, says, fascinating podcasts. Danny manages to review some truly interesting and inspiring people. Required listening if you work in the tech industry. And Tabby W1 says, great all-around podcast. Top guests, well-edited, and perfectly presented. And she ends with the little, you know, the little double hand emoji thing, which I've never quite understood, but I know it's a good thing. So anyhow, one more episode next week, then we're off for a bit. Thank you all so much for listening to keep the reviews coming in. And with that, I will leave you over to Pete.
Ultimately, we want to build an institution. We look at Silicon Valley and we look at technology and we think it's not prepared for the future. We can, in some ways, turn the venture model inside out.
This is the future. This is where the future is made, isn't it?
Silicon Valley?
Yeah.
Seems that way. Whether it's for people who are living here or people come here, yeah. This is a remarkable place to be.
So why does it need to be turned inside out, the venture world?
Well, we think we could do it much better. There's still a lot of money around at the seed stage, but the operational expertise and entrepreneurial expertise that this team, NFX, brings together is super unique. We've founded, been involved in founding 10 companies that have exits of $10 billion. We've invested in 300 companies all over the world. Second, where we think about what is a great venture capital firm of the future look like? And just in the same way that almost every great organization and company today has to have a great software backbone. We look at venture capital and it's kind of medieval. We've been up and down Sand Hill Road. We've been round and round South Park in San Francisco, yeah, banging on doors, asking for money. It's crazy how kind of antiquated this business is. So we're—
give me an example.
You know, investors will somewhat proudly tell you that 99% of the people that they meet, they never invest in.
Doesn't that just mean they're super smart and can separate the wheat from the chaff, et cetera?
No, they're wasting their time. I mean, it's like incredibly inefficient. You know, I think we're trying to bring, you know, realizing that at the earliest stage there's a combination of incredible human component. It is fundamentally about the people, combined with a sort of software workflow efficiency. So we've seen how kind of Wall Street has been transformed, or City of London has been transformed by technology over the last 30 years. The same thing will happen in many ways to venture capital, we believe.
So in other words, like AI helping you choose potential investees, for example?
Yes. The more data that's built up, the more insights we can build up, the better it can help ourselves and help our portfolio. We help to use software to connect all our portfolio companies together, sharing data, sharing insights. We launched a fundraising platform called Signal, which is free to anyone, which enables entrepreneurs to come on board and sign up and connect with other investors through a warm introduction. So we're building these software tools really to empower entrepreneurs with technology tools. I remember back in kind of the early days in the UK, lastminute.com, we found investors randomly through—
can we talk about lastminute.com? Because you're obviously— your accent gives you away. Just like mine does.
It's fading, but yeah.
You're obviously not from these shores. I read your Wikipedia page.
I'm an Essex boy.
Yeah. You have siblings, or what was your kind of upbringing?
So my father is now a retired professor, physical chemistry professor.
Where did he teach?
So University of London, Birkbeck College. So he was— it was amazing because my mother was a high school school teacher. So so she taught mostly ancient history, some Greek and Latin and French and a few other things. I mean, we would just travel, you know, he'd be teaching all over the world. So we'd grow up— we lived in Virginia.
Virginia.
For 6 months, he was teaching at UVA, wow, Charlottesville. I think that's probably why it was comfortable to come here.
Yeah.
To Palo Alto originally. So lots of travel, and it's very interesting, you know, sort of scientists, you know, technology, and growing up around that. And then I have an older brother who is— he has a super interesting job. So he runs Skybet. So he's the CEO there.
Oh.
It's a $1 billion British company, British technology company. So he—
so the Flint boys done well.
I guess. Yeah, we did all right. So so he's Skybet. I don't know all the numbers, but there was— I think they're doing incredibly well. So they span off from Sky, independent entity with private equity backing, and doing incredibly well. It's an industry where the UK is leading.
Absolutely. You went to Oxford, I believe.
Undergraduate degree at Oxford, physics.
And then decided you wanted to be an internet person.
Yeah, well, I was studying at Oxford, and like many people at university, you take summer jobs. I worked at a bank, an investment bank, JP Morgan, because they paid the most amount of money. And it was the summer of 1995. And it was the summer that Netscape went public. As often on these internship things, they put the intern on the most kind of like sort of orthogonal area. So they peak, go and find out about the internet. There's this like, tell us what we need to know.
Was that literally your marching orders?
Yeah,
go find out about the internet.
It was. Like, I realized two things. One is I didn't want to be an investment banker. And the other was just this internet thing was just astounding. So I said, well, I'm not going to work for a bank. I'm going to see what's going on the internet. And so the next summer, I actually wrote to every single internet firm in the UK.
How many were there?
About 18. So anyway, I got a job at a joint venture in News International. I worked at the Times building called Line One. Line One was kind of like trying to be the AOL of the UK. Content from News International, the Sky properties, the newspapers, combined with the connectivity of British Telecom. It was actually pretty amazing. So there was incredible talent, a lot of resources, opened many doors. But it was also like this incredibly messed up corporate marriage between these big companies that the press didn't want to cannibalize their existing businesses at that point.
This sounds very familiar.
Right.
20 years on or 25 years on.
Yeah, it was great on paper, but never kind of materialized. And so, but anyway, there was amazing people there. And one of my colleagues there was Brent Hoberman. Founder of Last Minute. And then when he raised money for Last Minute with Martha, then he asked me to join as one of a couple of the first employees. Launched in fall of 1998.
What did you do there? What was your job?
The single most important thing I was focused on was what they call today was growth. So this is interactive marketing. So I was responsible for getting traffic to the website.
Did you know what you were doing?
I knew more than the next guy. You remember there were 18 companies.
Right, maybe there were
20 then, but I mean, that was an amazing time, like an absolutely incredible time. Like, you know, went public in March 2000 at the peak of the NASDAQ. Last Minute was amazing in many things, and PR was one of them. It's like it was a kind of incredible story from a business perspective, from a product perspective. You know, Brent and Martha have gone to do incredible things. They're incredible individuals as well. So it caught the public's imagination in a massive way. And then company went public, and then just that time the bubble popped and everything went down. And I often think if I kind of quit business at that time, in my entire working career would be in this sort of first phase of the internet, which was like all bubble and all growth and all momentum.
Did you think about quitting?
I didn't. It was both an incredible culture. People weren't there for the money. They were there because this was an incredible team. So the first phase of Last Minute was about how do you hire people? How do you grow quickly? How do you sort of figure out the right kind of processes to put in? And the second phase was like, how do you build a real business? So like 2001, 2002, it's like we were...
Those are the hard yards.
Yeah, it was like a double whammy because the dot-com collapsed. And then secondly, like September the 11th happened. So you kind of once we... People stop traveling. Once you digest the human tragedy, you think about the business consequences. Like no one wants to go on a plane after they see planes smashing into buildings. So the business was kind of struggling. And so that period of 2001 to 2003 was when you figure out, okay, how do you build a proper business? And the timing, you know, while it in many ways was unfortunate, was hugely valuable because it enabled a company that had pretty sizable scale to figure out, okay, suppliers need to sell stuff, consumers are cautious, price sensitive, everything else, and the internet become online. So they started to come online in droves. And that, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005 was a huge business.
And then you left.
Yeah, so I left in 2003. It became a different company, and I kind of felt that we'd, like, became roughly profitable.
Yeah. More or less.
It wasn't, like, going to go bankrupt, a definitely possibility, like, a few years earlier. Then I left and I moved to, I got accepted to go to Stanford to do a MBA, doing internet in London. Great company, great job. But like going to Silicon Valley and like spending a couple of years in California. And
I've talked to people who like you going to because Stanford has such a beautiful campus.
Exactly. I remember vividly walking down before I even sort of stepped on campus, like this is a no-brainer. And you know, this is where the incredible companies are made, like Google and Yahoo and eBay, like icons of technology industry.
And then when did Zillow happen, or how did that come about? I mean, sorry, Trulia.
The way that sort of campus housing works, the first year they put you up in sort of halls of residence, and the second year you're on your own. And I was like, okay, so this is Silicon Valley. Like, I want to find somewhere to live. And yet, at the time, you could, you know, obviously buy flights online and hotels and groceries. You can find wives.
And then go to the newspaper to find your place to live.
And literally, the only place you'd... There was this thing called Craigslist, and it's a sort of this almost communist platform where people can share and post, and so massive kind of, you know, classified business, but it wasn't really professionally done. And so there was Craigslist on the internet, and then the rest of it was newspapers and speaking to agents. And I was just astounded at that this, you know, incredible part of the US economy was not a, you know, it's not exposed on the internet. So like, so I kind of started thinking about this, researching more into it, and I just became sort of fascinated by this idea. I was captivated. I couldn't, you know, I started thinking about it, iterating on it. And Stanford is just this amazing resource where the MBA program sort of, you know, you almost think like a CEO every single day. In the case studies you do, you have investors like who are just hanging around looking to invest in students, graduate students. And it's just that
it's like guys at the playground, like just kind of
take some money. Come on, son, take some money. No, there are. There's
I'm sure.
So they, but you know, and that cultural entrepreneurial spirit, which is infectious. So I basically like used every kind of piece of class credit against this project. I have everything I could meet with. Whether it's agents and brokers and computer scientists, and you know, I used to phone up these people at big organizations, big franchisors and brokers, and say, "Hey, I'm a Stanford student doing a project on real estate."
It's like the perfect, it's the perfect cover.
A perfect cover, and they would like, of course, let me spend an hour. This is intellectual philanthropy for them.
Right.
Whereas, you know, a year later, when I was like, not a student running a startup, I was, you know, they didn't give me the time of day.
Mm. Who invested in you first?
So our first round came from a bunch of mostly angels. They invested in our first round, which we closed a couple of million bucks before we launched.
Did you have kind of like an Uber-like experience where you kind of get into this industry that is, in fact, dominated by some pretty sharp-elbowed operators and almost kind of cartel-like behavior? I mean, how hard was it to kind of... Was it hard?
There was a perception, certainly then, that real estate agents were going to go the same way as travel agents. In the US, it's 6% typically to sell your home.
6%?
6%. And there was a perception that the reason it was so high was sort of the information asymmetry that was, and the opaqueness of this industry, and the agents had access to all the information. And the internet came along, is going to expose this information, was going to like crush commissions. And so there was this massive protectionism, for want of a better word, around technology and the internet and massive lobbying. And so we actually launched with the positioning of like, we're just a couple of Stanford graduate students.
Tinkering in our garage.
Initially, it was more on the positioning as a search engine for real estate. We launched just around when Google was going public, and it's like, and we saw Google doing this generalized search, and we're like, okay, there is like going to be specific vertical search. And so we kind of saw real estate was a discrete problem with discrete particular search behavior. And so, yeah, real estate search was how we launched. The challenge that's with all these marketplaces, and again, it's a network effect business, you have this chicken and egg problem of like, if you don't have consumers, you can't get listings, you don't have consumers. So our goal was to kind of fly under the radar as this sort of student project to get enough scale and to get enough people working with us to have enough sort of critical mass. As it happened, we got a whole bunch of cease and desist. And
I was going to say, did you get the kind of the equivalent of the horse's head in your bed? Kind of, or many horse heads?
The thing that we were doing was fundamentally not about putting real estate agents out of business, and it never has been. The idea for us was to be like, okay, we want to be the consumer's best friend and helping them find real estate information. So the best content, all the historical transactions, everything else, combined with a great user experience, and we'll make our money by just saying, like, don't spend on the local newspaper classified advertising, spend money online. It's more accountable, it's more trackable, it's more efficient. We started in 2005, and that was a kind of tough pitch. We didn't have users, we didn't have much product. As you might imagine, what happened in real estate over the next subsequent years it absolutely resonated. So we grew very, very rapidly, consumer traffic to the website. And at the same time, brokers and agents said, well, this is a super efficient way to market my properties and to market myself.
And then 2008 happens.
And then 2008 happened. So, yeah, I seem to have the worst luck. And he's like, being in travel in 2001, yeah, exactly. Being in real estate in 2008.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the eye of the storm because you have the real estate collapse, which precipitated the global financial collapse. And so house prices went down a third, transactions went down a third. The industry was decimated. Kind of felt that two things were going to happen. Like, you know, the world was going to end, the banks were going to collapse, and like that scenario, nothing really matters.
Yeah, you're like, oh man, my company failed, exactly. But I need to find some canned goods.
I know. So we get to medieval times, which was like the speculation at the time. Or like, once you sort of dusted yourself off, you actually realize like this is, you know, it's actually a really good opportunity. Like you go back to like what happened in travel, like the great travel brands were built in 2001, 2002, 2003. And like we saw like it's sort of Western civilization is going to survive, then let's double down. So we'd seen some of the economic indicators kind of tick and like and tip in early 2008. So we raised $15 million. So we'd raised money from Axel Partners in 2005, just as we launched. Sequoia Capital in 2007.
And then they put out that famous RIP Good Times presentation.
So Sequoia is one, if not the most famous venture capital institution in the world. And they gathered all their portfolio companies, myself included, and said...
Did you know what this was, what it was about when they said, yeah, everybody come for this little meeting?
We kind of thought that it might be like a little sort of pep talk about how to navigate in uncertain times. But it was a lot more shocking. So they wanted to create an impression. You need to move quickly. You need to become profitable as quickly as possible because there's no more financing available.
I remember I was going back before we met and some of the coverage. And I think this, when was that? It was in 2008, but before the proverbial hit the fan.
Yeah, September 2008. It was a week before like Lehman collapse.
Right. And, I remember there was... I read that they used images from like the Great Depression and, you know, tombstones and all this kind of very...
I think the front cover was like a slaughtered pig. The message was that you're going to end up in like the slaughterhouse unless you act quick. Time is everything in a crisis.
Yeah. And entrepreneurs are by nature quite optimistic.
Exactly. And they've been through this before and they realize that the best way to save the company is to cut deep, as quickly as possible, to give yourself a long enough runway because there's no chance of raising additional financing in the short term. And most of the companies, these early stage loss-making businesses. So yeah, that was fun.
So did you walk out of that meeting and slash and burn, or were you already getting ready to kind of...
I mean, the real estate market had been declining for the previous 2 years. We kind of didn't really take their advice in many ways. We kind of... I know, we were like... They were telling us to kind of cut, and we were like, no, like this is the time to like double down.
Right.
So it was a bit contentious at the time.
Oh, wow.
You know, like I said, the world is going to end, or we need to build a great business. So we didn't actually fire anyone, but we kind of kept things
pretty
stable.
Did that warrant a talking to from your backers? What the hell are you doing?
I mean, I think we were always pretty capital efficient. But again, we were like, okay, this is... You know, a whole bunch of things had to kind of happen, but this is like our moment. So, and again, exactly the supply-demand imbalance. There's all this inventory online, just like happened in travel. Consumers were confused and bemused. And so really at that point, we kind of did a couple of things. So one was like, we did a sort of like, it sounds sort of soft, but super important, but culture building. Like we need to build the team spirit to navigate. This was like an incredible journey we were going on, so yeah. Making sure the team was super solid.
So the world is kind of crashing down around you. Do you go for like an away day, like paintballing or something?
Well, it is just like spending time with the team and like talking about what this means and opportunities. And I think I've learned over the years that like the Britishness in me is like, if there's a problem, you kind of hold on to it and you don't share it.
Oh, let's not talk about that, of course.
Yes, I know what's there about your problems, young man. And sort of insecurity and kind of challenges are not best aired. But we kind of turned it on its head and said, okay, this is the situation we're in. We have so much money in the bank. We're not going to be raising any more money. This is the industry. People are still going to be buying houses at some point. And sort of, you know, being pretty open with the team about these are all the problems that we're facing. And it sort of drove this buy-in from the team that, okay, this is a pretty interesting opportunity and we can start to change the face of US real estate. So there was a whole bunch of cultural stuff internally, which is really important to build this foundation. Secondly, it was trying to work with the real estate industry. So suddenly we turned from being this kind of like sort of curious, like real estate website, what's this about, to being the industry's best friend and the kind of the opportunity out of their own challenging situations.
Right, because they could use you to get their inventory in front of customers.
Exactly. So we were the most effective form of marketing for them. And the third, we needed to figure out how we were going to shift our business model. So we went from selling things at the corporate level to selling advertising packages and promotional packages to corporates, to basically building out this massive inside sales force and getting hundreds of people on the phone, literally calling real estate agents to monetize individual real estate agents.
To get them to advertise on the platform.
To get them to advertise.
Right. So cold calling.
Cold calling, yeah. Initially, this was born out of agents calling us
right.
and saying, hey, we'd like to be featured, more business. And then over time, we basically like figured out who are the ones that most likely to buy and call them
right.
proactively because
right,
they're
right.
already using our platform. Yeah, so we became profitable in 2010, roughly sort of break even, and then went public in 2012.
And were you like, I've arrived? How was it? Did you feel like
going public? I mean, it's like a pretty epic sort of experience. I think it's sort of, you know, they're like a few years earlier, you thought we might go out of business, we might go bankrupt. So in the New York Stock Exchange.
Did you ring the bell, the opening bell?
Ringing, get the hammer, ring the bell. I had some exposure to it last minute, involved with the IPO and, you know, at the London Stock Exchange. That was an awkward experience when we're there because as soon as... Well, it was awkward because like we just sold a bunch of stock to investors and then as soon as we went public, the price started slipping. There was a sense of kind of like awkwardness.
You sold us a pup.
It was different with Trulia where it was just the momentum was building.
Right.
You know, we'd come out of the recession and it was great.
And when you went public, how much was the company valued at?
Around 500 million. Maybe a little bit less, 400 million, 400 to 500 million. So pretty small, you know, at the time, pretty small IPO.
Tiny. So things kind of gallop on until 2014?
Yeah, so we were building the business and everything was going great. And then I got a call from our closest competitor, the chairman, founder of Zillow, Rich Barton. He called me. I remember vividly in the morning, he called me and said, Pete, you know, you're around for dinner next week. I'd like to chat to you about some stuff that we think we could do together. And I was literally at the airport about to go on a two-week vacation. And
you bet your wife loved that.
And I said to him, no, I'm really busy and I can't meet up. You know, I didn't want to tell him I was going on vacation. I wanted him to think that I was like,
yeah, doing deals.
I didn't sleep. I was like working 100 hours a week. And then he said to me, Pete, I've got a letter here in front of me signed by my board of directors that we're interested in combining forces. So I really think we should meet for dinner next week.
And then
I
had to tell him, I've got to go to Essex.
And then I told him and he was like, he felt terrible because he was clearly going to ruin my vacation. But so yeah, about a month later, we announced that we were combining forces with Zillow. You know, this is like the number one and number two real estate sites merging. You know, initially it was, my feeling was like, why would I do that? This is an amazing job, amazing company. Like combining with
I was going to ask, is there any kind of like, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Initially it was like, why would I do that? Because I think we'd been competing. It's one of those situations where we were, you know, the market had shifted. We started being the category started being a product battle. People would use Trulia because it had this.
I was going to say, because when you look at the product, it's actually, I mean, they're basically doing the same thing, right?
Exactly. So come like 2014, you know, I could tell you three things that they had that we didn't have and vice versa, but we were basically doing the same thing. So it had shifted from a product battle to a marketing battle. We were spending collectively like $150 million on advertising, a bunch of that on TV. So we were just going head to head, like on Wall Street, head to head on the TV networks, head to head on Google and Facebook. And it was just like, it came after a while, spending time with them. It's like, they're really great guys. They're really incredible team. Similar DNA. The Rich Barden, the founder, founded Expedia. So we kind of had this shared history of being in travel.
Right.
We'd sort of grown up together. The Zillow team came out of travel pretty much. So we realized, okay, we could combine forces and we could do what we wanted to do in 2019, in 2017. And so however kind of painful it is, it's like, it's a terrific opportunity for shareholders, for employees and kind of for the business.
And it valued the company at $3.5 billion at the time?
Announcement, $3.5 billion, so stock for stock merger. Even if your heart is saying, maybe I don't want to lose my job, it's like, your head is saying, makes a sense. So we had to go through about 9 months of antitrust review, as you might imagine, go through the FTC and all that process, which was no fun, but necessary.
And I read, again, on the internet, you can never trust what's on the internet, but I read that your kind of stake was worth about $150 million at the time, ish.
Stock for stock, I can't remember exactly, but
ballparky.
I know. You journalists, you dig up these things. So.
And so that happens, but then you stayed.
So I chose at that time to step out of an operational role. Didn't need two CEOs, but I joined the board of directors to help with the integration. You know, literally at the end of it, I was like the biggest cheerleader.
How did you celebrate?
Actually, so my 40th birthday was on literally the day before we announced it. So I guess that the celebration, in fact, was like I gave my wife my phone, because my phone was just like, the stuff had leaked to the press at this point. Like, you take my phone, because I don't want to, like, I'd basically turn my phone off for 3 hours and had dinner. So that was...
3 whole hours.
Yeah, I know. So that was the sort of most visible kind of memory. And then, so while I was on the board, I basically took a little over a year off of kind of full-time working, travel around Europe with my family.
Jump off of cliffs and do crazy things?
Not really.
Or just like quiet Airbnbs.
Well, I had a three-year-old and a pregnant wife, so there was no jumping off cliffs,
yeah,
but like, yeah. You know, spend some time in Europe seeing family.
That's quite cool.
Nothing too crazy.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And so once that happens, obviously everybody knows the deal and it's this amazing success. Could you talk about getting into the kind of the world of angel investing? Because I find it so fascinating here how it works. I mean, it's such a machine here. How does it work? you're part of the club now.
Yeah, so I was kind of stuck in San Francisco, even though kind of I could have traveled and jumped off cliffs in Bali. It's like, you know, we're having a second child and daughter at school. So I was like hanging around San Francisco. People realize you have time available. So I kind of got dozens of people emailing me and say, hey, I've got a startup idea. Can I get your perspective on it? Can I pick your brains? And so I basically...
How quickly does that start?
The next day.
Right.
The next day. So I kind of got a lot of sort of inbound interest. And then there were these pretty clear sort of connectors and informal networks between kind of angel syndicates and investors and venture capitalists. So venture capitalists approached me and said, you know, let's do some deals together. If venture capitalists want, there's this whole kind of ecosystem where the big name venture capitalists often kind of work with angel investors that kind of as a deal flow, and they pass deals between each other, maybe too early for a big fund, but the angel investors can evaluate them. And so this whole ecosystem, you know, I was literally like 10 to 4 p.m. most days a week, I would be meeting with entrepreneurs and like they would be pitching me. And it's just this sort of incredibly fertile startup space. There's so many startups.
What's the craziest idea that was pitched to you?
I think the kind of craziness is like when it, you know, this cyborg stuff or genetic stuff where, you know...
Cyborg stuff?
Cyborgs and, you know, creating sort of...
Here's my cyborg startup. Can you give me money?
They don't necessarily pitch it like that, but they like...
I'm going to work on my delivery, but you know what I mean.
This is like, this is where it's headed. There's a whole bunch of these things, which, you know, I didn't invest in. I made, you know, there's some wacky ones I did invest in, which later turned out to be really good. But so one of the ones I did invest in is Plenty, which...
We interviewed.
You met Matt.
Yes.
You interviewed him. So this is a company that was introduced by a mutual friend, and it's this vertical growing company. So
indoor farm warehouses.
Indoor farming. It's like, it's a kind of wacky idea. It's a whole bunch of software, agriculture. It is at the time, it's kind of wacky. And then you look at it where they are today. They've raised hundreds of millions of dollars.
It's like they're SoftBank's favorite food company.
Yeah, it's like, and they're going to revolutionize food. It's funny how these ideas that they kind of initially look like wacky.
Because when they came to you, are they still just a deck?
Yeah, there were some prototypes at the Google campus. Nothing built. And it's interesting how kind of, you know, software is sort of permeating all these different parts of our world. And, you know, you can combine these techniques with a good team and amazing stuff happens. So,
and are you the only angel investor who hasn't invested in Uber? Everybody I talk to is like, oh, I was in Uber real early.
I was not in Uber. I missed that one, unfortunately. That was like, I was kind of running a public company when that was
kind of
happening.
Busy. Yeah.
So I missed that one.
So we circle back to NFX because you started this a few years ago, right?
So NFX started 2015 by James Curry and Gigi Leverweiss, my partners. And then I joined about a year after they launched.
But this isn't kind of a formalization then of your angel investments. That's separate.
No, exactly. It's separate. So James and Gigi started working together in 2015. I joined in 2016, really doing kind of small scale investments together. And then this $150 million fund is really what we think of our launch. So this is, you know, institutional capital. We're doing a combination of seed stage investing as well as sort of early. We run an early stage program for entrepreneurs where we invest $250K to help them get going. And so, yeah, we're pretty excited.
And how does it, within 2017, how does the UK look relative to Silicon Valley? Is it still light years behind or is it catching up? You know, I was just there for a few weeks and people are saying, well, it does appear that there is a lot more going on there than there was, but, you know, it's all relative. I don't know.
Yeah, so I used to, you know, I've been back and forth for the last... 14 years, and there used to be this observed latency between the kind of ideas that happen in Silicon Valley and what happened in London. I'd say that 14 years ago, that latency was around 18 months, and now I think it's kind of compressed to, you know, on average around kind of 6 to 9 months, And in certain sectors, I think it's, you know, it's sort of similar velocity.
Right.
So, you know, things like fintech, some of the blockchain stuff, you know, some healthcare stuff is similar. You know, those are generally industries where they've kind of perhaps less regulation or less burdensome than the US systems. And so they're executing super fast. So, but the big difference, I think, today versus like the last minute days has been the talent. So like there's just been this homegrown talent that's been built over the years that's turning kind of good ideas and good entrepreneurs into successful businesses. And back in 2000 period, at the lastminute.com CTOs, we'd kind of ship out the, like we'd hire like a bunch of American business people that would go and work in London with us for a couple of years. So, you know, that a bunch of the VPs were Americans.
You don't have to do that anymore.
You don't have to do that anymore. And that talent base kind of helps to recycle and build. And that really is the secret of Silicon Valley. The talent, the people that is moving between companies.
Yeah.
And then that is starting to happen in London in a pretty meaningful way, which is helping to foster, you know, a bunch of, I think, more meaningful and interesting companies.
So does that mean you're going to move back to the UK? Move back to Essex?
No. No, it's pretty amazing. This is great. No, we're here. It's a very special place. I think I kind of moved out originally for 2 years, like, oh, I study and then go back. And you kind of get addicted to the entrepreneurial attitude. You know, in the UK, it's like, if there's a problem, people kind of grumble about it. Whereas here, it's like, oh yeah, how do we fix that?
Yeah.
Oh, I know someone that could do something there. And so there's that sort of attitude, plus it's a beautiful part of the world. And
is there one investment from your angel investing that you passed on that you wish you hadn't?
I'm sure there are. I'm trying to think. There was a time in early lastminute.com days where it's in a very unique environment. So you'd meet everyone from like Mark Zuckerberg to Drew Houston at Dropbox and to the Uber founders. And I wasn't angel investing there because I was kind of bootstrapping. We were just surviving.
Right.
So every piece.
But you were kind of one of them trying to.
Yeah, we'd go out for dinner and talk about stuff and like, how do you build businesses? And like.
Really?
Not everyone, but you like, you go and like share ideas with your fellow right. entrepreneurs. And so, yeah, for sure. If I, you know, if I'd been more active then, and had some liquidity, then I would have like.
Yeah. Of all of that kind of up and down and up and down, was there one kind of your worst day of work?
Worst day at work. I think that sort of period around the sort of, it's those crisis days. It's like both September the 11th and whatever, October 2008. You're like the CEO of the company, you're the founder, you're like, and you know, however much you kind of believe like there's an opportunity, you have this like, you manage like, what were we, 50, 60 people at that point? And everyone is telling you kind of, real estate is terrible, internet is terrible, and you kind of have to hold it together. Those are like, those are nightmares.
You have to kind of fake it till you make it.
I don't know. Well, I wouldn't say fake it till you make it, but just there's a sort of like, you have no choice in a way of like, this is it. Like, you know, you got to like go out there. And you have all these, you know, all the team looking at you and trying to like, okay, this is this really, they're going to turn this around. Those are the most stressful times of trying to like, you're a first time CEO. I was like 31 or 32 or something then. And you're in charge of this money from investors and you've got to navigate this world. Those were the most stressful time, but I think they create bonds between the team members that's like inseparable. And you know, right. Same with Brent and Martha, same with my team at Trulia, that their experiences, which sure you had sleepless nights, but the kind of formative experience that now as an investor I want to try and help the next set of like first time CEOs to figure that stuff out.
And that is all the time we have. Thank you to Pete for sharing his very fascinating story and lessons from the wild world of the internet over the past 20 years. I will leave you to your weekend. I hope it's a good one. Please do stop on Apple Podcasts. Do keep the reviews coming. They really are a huge help keeping the show kind of high in the rotation, helping others find it. And you can find me, as always, in the newspaper, at the Sunday Times, online at thetimes.co.uk, and on Twitter, at Danny Fortson. Have a good weekend, and talk to you next week.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.